Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping the future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, tensions rise as the South African Reserve Bank's surprise inflation target shift sparks a policy rift. Global skies show a luxury lift with a sharp rise in premium air travel. Alarm is growing over the rising number of police linked to partner killings. And South African companies report big gains in the battle for top talent. It's a Tuesday, the 5th of August. Now, South Africa's Reserve Bank has quietly tightened its inflation targeting, now aiming squarely at 3%, down from the long-standing 3-6% range. But the move, if you've been following this story, has drawn fire from the Finance Minister, Enoch Godongwana, who says no formal shift is on the cards, at least not without full cabinet consultation. So I'm wondering if this is the start of a deeper power struggle between the Treasury and the Reserve Bank. I'm joined in that respect by economist Adrian Saville, who holds a professorship in economics and finance and strategy at the Gordon Institute of Business Science. So, Adrian, a very warm welcome. The SARB says it now prefers a 3% target. As I've just outlined, the finance minister says that's not official policy. What's the conventional wisdom here? Has the Reserve Bank overstepped its mandate?
Jeremy, great to be with you. Yes, it would seem to be from, you know, the narrative that you've outlined that they've stepped outside of mandate. And that's going to, exactly as you've suggested, you know, it translates very quickly into a power struggle. And you've got two elephants here. You've got the Reserve Bank and Treasury wrestling over, what the number is and who gets to set it. There's a bigger story in the backdrop, which is debate as to whether this should be a sensible policy in the first place. But you're absolutely, you know, on the money in terms of highlighting the tensions that this has created. Markets, capital allocators hate uncertainty. And so into an economy that is already stuttering to find investor confidence, this is not the best way to play it.
Having said that, Adrian, is there method in the announcement from the SARB? Why would it be making the shift now, particularly in the absence of formal Treasury approval or any kind of cabinet directive? Does it make economic sense, do you think?
Look, from leave the country story aside, leave the politics aside, if we just focus on the 3% target, this makes eminent sense for a number of reasons. The first is it puts us much closer in line with our major trading partners, who are all running 2 and 3% targets. And if your domestic rate is running in line with international rates of your trading partners, then your currency in the fullness of time is going to be far more stable. And so price stability, currency stability is going to translate into far steadier and better coordinated international trade relationships. It also affords, in the fullness of time, interest rates to come down to a level, you know, from what at the moment sit at very elevated real rates, 4, 5, 6%, depending on whether you're using prime or repo. These are very high real interest rates by any standard, by South Africa's standard and global standards. So it allows us to get interest rate into a more sensible glide path. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, good wisdom behind that 3% target.
Is a lot of this not a fait accompli anyway, particularly if the SARB starts modeling off a 3% target? Doesn't that effectively mean a tightening of monetary policy anyway?
Well, I'm not entirely sure that it does mean tighter policy because, you know, to go back to your earlier point, why make the announcement now? Because inflation has been tame, moderate, domestically, globally. We've got a rand that's strengthened. Oil prices have been well-behaved. And it all points to a relatively steady, stable inflation rate environment where, you know, as things stand, we're hovering around 3, and it looks like we'll nudge a little higher going into the later part of the year. But I don't think that it translates into tighter monetary policy. The monetary policy discipline has been in the chamber for some time, and it has translated into this low inflation rate.
Adrian, it's all about the optics, though, surely. Would global markets, and by that I mean investors, read this as disciplined monetary policy or maybe yes, some institutional confusion?
So maybe I said yes too quickly there. So, Jeremy, I think the first signal is exactly that. It's the South African Reserve Bank is well-regarded, you know, amongst, forget it, I don't even need to put the term emerging market central banks, amongst central banks globally, the South African Reserve Bank, you know, stands head and shoulders. It truly is, you know, a powerful institution. And this is part of that signaling. You know, it says we're here to look after the mandate of protecting the value of the currency, that they mean business. And it really is a, you know, it's a sober, fair, direct message. The however that we can now put into the economic sentences, however, as you point out, in order to get that in place, it now seems that we've got institutions putting on armor and, you know, heading into battle.
How do you think the ratings agencies would read this?
What a great question. 50-50. I think that, you know, on the one hand, they would say, you know, this is exactly the type of signaling that you would want from your central bank, and keeping in mind that the Reserve Bank is truly independent, and you know, they could have an unspoken mandate. They don't have to broadcast this. They could just keep, you know, in pursuit of that 3% target. So I think it signals the discipline of the South African Reserve Bank. But then, you know, on the other hand, there's now this mandate confusion. And so I think that they're going to do a 50-50 on this until that dust settles.
Just in economic terms going forward, do you think a consistent 3% inflation rate would actually be achievable?
Very difficult for South Africa because we are a small open economy and about 30% of the economy is imported. So when the rand moves, you get immediately, well, when the rand weakens, you immediately get imported inflation. When the rand strengthens, you import deflation. And so there's a very high sensitivity to currency movements. So the only way in which a 3% target would also translate into steady, stable 3% inflation is if the rand starts to behave in line with those trading partners and get into, you know, a far more moderated, significantly less volatile snake or tunnel. Then, yes, 3% could be on the cards.
And Adrian, finally, you know, you've got two big elephants here trampling the grass. For ordinary South Africans, and I'm thinking about bond payers, I'm thinking about small business owners, how should they be looking at this? With a degree of concern, or what sentiment do you think that they might have?
Well, I think, you know, broadly, you know, South Africans should be focused on the importance of institutional integrity. We've unfortunately become, you know, well-schooled in what happens when institutions get compromised. And here you have Treasury and the Reserve Bank, which have been well-managed, well-run, have withstood, you know, significant tests, the Reserve Bank in particular. So I think you want to give disproportionate attention to institutional integrity and that this doesn't turn into, you know, a duel that could be avoided. But for the, you know, in the ordinary course of business, I don't think that there's much to talk about here. You know, we can sort of move along and carry on business as usual. The however is what would concern me is if there is a compromise of the independence of the Reserve Bank, which is quite distinct from, you know, questioning whether they have the authority to state the size of the mandate or the inflation target. That's a different issue. It's critical that the independence isn't in any way compromised.
Adrian Saville, as always, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Jeremy.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, it's been a bumpy year for global aviation, with passenger numbers soaring and premium class travel surging ahead. The International Air Transport Association releasing its 2024 World Air Transport Statistics Report. And let me tell you, it's a goldmine of insight into how, where and what the world is flying. I want to discuss these trends and what they mean for travelers, airlines and regional markets. I'm joined by well-known aviation analyst and commentator Lyndon Burns. Lyndon, premium class, this is interesting, growing by nearly 12% last year. That's faster than many economies. Do you think it's a post-COVID boom or a deeper shift maybe in airline economics?
Hi, Jeremy. I think it's a combination of two things, and it's where that growth is taking place. And significantly, that boom in premium class travel is happening in Asia Pacific. It's growing at like 28%, which is phenomenal. And I think, you know, if you look across not just last year's numbers, but also this year, what's been happening, of course, this year is a very different picture globally because of the three T's, you know, Trump, trade and tariffs. Asia Pacific seems to be, I won't say immune, but more immune than anyone else. It seems to be a very resilient market, a lot of strong intra Asia Pacific trade and commerce and tourism that's happening. And so we're seeing there that in the premium market, it was what, 21 million premium passengers. It was a year-on-year growth of 22.8% last year just in that market. And we're seeing similar this year. It's, if we look at June's numbers for this year, year-on-year, it's 9% up on the same last year. Whereas if we look at Africa, for example, we're a much smaller market. We only represent about 2% of the global market. We've got about just under 4 million premium travelers within the travel with African Airlines last year. And we're seeing that market growing at around 5.5% for premium travel. And we're seeing about 11% for economy travelers. 57 million economy travelers traveled with African Airlines last year. But again, if we look across at this year, it's a lot slower. We've seen only a 0.8% rise in demand for passenger travel in the African market in June this year compared to last year. And a lot of that's down to, again, you know, increased competition, the fact that within Africa, we've got a very low propensity to travel because of the low per capita income compared to places like the Asia Pacific, Europe and North America.
And Lyndon, that observation is in the data because there are 3.3 million passengers on the Johannesburg to Cape Town route. It's Africa's busiest route. It tells us a lot then about intra-country versus cross-border travel on the continent and where the balance is.
Yeah, absolutely. I was actually surprised by that number. The more people that travel between Cape Town and Joburg than travel between New York, JFK, and Los Angeles.
Wow.
Last year, they only had 2.2 million passengers on that route. So, yes, it's a real headache. And this actually plays into the broader picture. You know, when the president says, oh, we need to pivot trade and look at intra-Africa and the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, you go, yeah, that's all very good, but can people in those markets afford our products and services? And we're seeing that reflected as it is in demand for air travel and for air cargo, because they do reflect, they're a very handy mirror or barometer, whichever analogy you want to use, of the state of trade, commerce and economic health.
So, Lyndon, in that respect then, and based on your observation and these trends, where should South Africa be focusing its efforts in order to stay relevant and competitive?
I think we need to be doing more everywhere, frankly. What's a little disconcerting is that the Africa-Asia trade lane was looking very healthy until about May this year, and then suddenly it started reversing, and we've seen those numbers declining for two consecutive months now. So that's not a good sign. I don't know to what extent that's influenced by seasonality, if it's to do with holidays or perishable good exports, or I'm not quite sure what it is, but it's not looking great. You'd think that we would be a very attractive source market as well as a destination, obviously for travelers because of the low cost, the weak rand, and therefore the great value for money proposition that we offer for foreign travelers. And you would also think that we'd be a competitive market for investment. But obviously, there are more fundamental issues here that we've got to deal with in South Africa, and we know what they are, to do with crime, corruption, governance, accountability. And it's all very good having all the other things, but if we don't have those, people aren't going to come.
And interesting to see the Boeing 737 and the Airbus A320 families remain the workhorses of aviation. Why are airlines still leaning so heavily on these two narrow-body jets? Is there no other alternative?
I think we're actually going to see even more use of the narrow-body aircraft as Boeing and Airbus start filling out their order books. The only other viable alternative in the same category, and we're talking about aircraft in the 150 to 200 seat bracket. You know, the Brazilians with Embraer make aircraft up to about 125, 130 seats. The only other manufacturer that's looking at breaking into that market is Comac from China, but the aircraft, first of all, is not yet fully certified, and it's not certified outside of China. And I think there's going to be an issue around how do they break through the resistance and the inertia in the market. They're going to have to satisfy the banks that those are, you know, solid investments, that they'll hold their residual value. They'll have to demonstrate to operators that they have good customer support and that there's, you know, deep supply lines. It's already a frustration in the industry at the moment with supply chain crisis. You can wait up to 3 years for some aircraft parts at the moment. Wow. And that's also why we're seeing a lot of the older 737s and A320s remaining in service longer than they would have, because, you know, the manufacturers aren't able to turn them out at the tempo they would have preferred to. They were hoping to be producing them at around about 60 a month each, but they're down at currently at about 30 and 40. And that's meaning that airlines have to keep all the aircraft in service for longer than they'd originally intended.
Lyndon, just a quick one in conclusion. Middle East has the highest share of premium passengers. Latin America, Europe, North America, all seeing premium travel outpace economy. So fair to say then that business travel is back now with a vengeance, or at least being redefined in one way or another.
I think so. And certainly last year, you know, I remember this report is 2024 numbers, and that's why I was kind of qualified at saying a lot's changed since then. Let's see how this year pans out. It'll be fascinating to see if that buoyancy and optimism that characterized last year, you know, in terms of trade and commerce continues, and that activity. You know, people obviously still see a lot of value in premium travel, and it's a very competitive space. We may not, South Africans, I think we're seeing it becoming more and more expensive, relatively speaking. But obviously, you know, for everyone else, it's seen as a good value proposition.
Lyndon Burns, as always, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The recent murder-suicide in Soweto involving a senior police officer has once again thrown a harsh and disturbing spotlight on the deadly intersection of intimate partner violence and law enforcement. The National Shelter Movement of South Africa says this is not an isolated incident, saying it's part of a dangerous pattern and it's time for urgent reform. So what sort of reform are we talking about? The executive head of the organization, Dr. Zubeda Dango, is with me now. Dr. Dango, a very warm welcome. In fact, you've called this a national emergency. What evidence are you seeing that this isn't just an isolated tragedy, but in fact a trend?
Yes, I mean, we're seeing this often. Many of these cases don't make the media and they don't get reported. So what happens is that these things are not highlighted. But when a police captain becomes a perpetrator of intimate partner femicide, then the system has failed survivors. And we should never fear institutions that are meant to protect women. This is one of my very big concerns. The police are there to help protect women, and so is the state. But both the police and the state are failing survivors of gender-based violence. This has become an issue over years. We talk about this as a shadow pandemic, but what are we doing about this? We have laws, we have policies. None of these are really translated into action that supports women. And I think because of this, we are failing, our constitution is being breached.
Dr. Dungo, let's talk a little bit about what the solutions might be in just a moment. But as far as the Soweto case is concerned, when a senior police officer commits a murder-suicide, it also sends out a signal, doesn't it, to survivors about the safety of turning to law enforcement. In fact, it's all an erosion of trust, isn't it?
Absolutely. As it is, we have a problem in South Africa. You know, the whole transition of the police from being a force to a service was a difficult transition. And that hasn't truly translated into police seen as people who service survivors of gender-based violence. And when this kind of thing happens, you actually, what is the message sent out to survivors? You're saying to them that you can't trust. And this becomes a huge problem because then people are not coming forward to try and get their issues resolved by going to the police station, reporting this and finding help because they feel that they are going to be blamed. They're going to be secondarily victimized. And with this kind of message, it's a stark message to survivors that, you know, the law enforcement is not there to actually support you.
So you're calling now, your organization is calling for mandatory risk assessments as well as firearm reviews for officers under investigation. All well and good, but is there enough political will or even capacity to enforce this?
Well, you see, this is the problem that basically we don't have enough political will, whether you're talking SAPS, whether you're talking the South African government. There isn't enough political will. And I believe that, you know, when South Africa really wants to, we can turn things around. As we did when, you know, the COVID pandemic struck us, we were able to immediately gather resources and act very quickly. The question becomes, why is it that when it comes to women and gender-based violence, that the wheels of change are so slow to turn? What is it about us as a society that we're not listening to, that we're not hearing? Are the lives of women that cheap?
Dr. Dungo, I'm curious to know why you think there is a lack of political will as far as this very serious issue is concerned.
The reason is, Jeremy, I've been in this field for more than 30 years, number one. Number two, we have good policies, we have good laws, but whenever you talk about any form of action that's being taken, there's never resources to actually match the kind of services that need to be run. You just take shelters for abused women. These are not adequately funded, you know, in South Africa. Currently, in Gauteng itself, we have a huge crisis with shelter funding. So shelters in Gauteng have to close. In southern Johannesburg, we do not have a service. And this is despite us screaming out at the relevant authorities, which includes the Gauteng Department of Social Development, the minister, Minister Tolashi, who've been told this directly, not even in writing, but personally and directly, about the need where survivors are going to be turned back to their perpetrators and eventually get killed. But we're not being heard. This is why I'm saying there isn't enough political will.
So, Dr. Dungo, finally then, is there anything the South African Police Service could be doing right now, immediately, to prevent guns from staying in the hands of officers accused of abuse?
So, I think it's very important that firstly, law enforcement must report this. They can't, they have to learn to fix what's going on. There has to be accountability. We need to be sure that if something like this happens, the officers get suspended immediately. And SAPS leadership needs to act. They need to start looking at how they can rebuild their trust with communities and hold their own accountable. The problem is we do not have enough accountability. And this is a huge thing. If you don't have accountability, we're not going to be able to fix anything, Jeremy.
Dr. Zubeida Dango, it is a very serious issue, and thank you for throwing some light on it for us today. You're the head or the executive head of the National Shelter Movement of South Africa. I appreciate your time and your insight.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africa is facing a deepening talent crisis. We've discussed this before. It's one shaped by rapid digital transformation, youth unemployment, skill shortages, and evolving employee expectations. But in this complex and often competitive labor market, some companies are now finding innovative ways to attract and retain top performers. From flexible pay models and AI-driven recruitment to a renewed focus on wellness and equity, it's the way in which we manage talent that is now being redefined. I want to talk now to Lindiwe Sebesho, who is a Master Reward Specialist and Executive Committee Member of the South African Reward Association. So, Lindiwe, no doubt South Africa's talent landscape is not only shifting, but it's shifting very, very quickly. What's the biggest difficulty, the biggest hurdle that is facing employers right now?
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you very much for the opportunity once again. I think what we're seeing is a lot of employers are struggling to find the right skill. There's been such a shift in the type of skills that the economy requires that a lot of employers are finding it difficult to match the available skills in the market with what's really needed. They're also struggling to manage and retain the skills that they have, ensure that they continuously evolve those to align with what's really required for the market to actually grow and for businesses to deliver their strategies.
And Lindiwe, adding to the problem, I imagine, is not only the issue around skills, which is an age-old one in this country, but there are also rapidly changing employee expectations, are there not?
Absolutely. So for those people that are highly skilled, we are seeing them highly mobile because not only are they in demand, but they also have different expectations in terms of what employers that retain them need to offer as part of their value proposition.
So what are some of the most in-demand skills this year? What are we looking at?
We're looking at a lot of data and technology skills, so roles like data scientists, AI specialists, IT security analysts are critical as businesses all try to digitize and optimize their operations to also become more efficient. As we know, everyone is cost constrained, so everyone is trying to look at best ways to deliver their services to clients in a cost-effective manner.
Not just the technological space, but you also refer to a shortage of artisans.
Yes, definitely. We're seeing those artisan trades becoming a bit more in demand. I mean, if you look at our infrastructure and the maintenance and upgrades that need to happen, Jeremy, a lot of municipal services require those skills. So skilled electricians, welders, plumbers, I mean, those we thought were not as important. But as we see the infrastructure development and, as I said, the need to maintain infrastructure increase, those skills are in demand indeed.
I should have taken my father's advice many decades ago and become a plumber. I think I would have made a lot of money. Lindiwe, there's also a clear move towards skills-based hiring and pay. So explain that to me in terms of how companies are practically implementing this and the impact maybe on traditional qualifications.
Absolutely. So, Jeremy, I think a lot of people, because of the education that we are seeing, are getting the qualifications that's needed, but it's the practical application of those in terms of what competence is needed to be productive in a job. So we are seeing a lot of employers focus more on making sure that they actually pay for that competence and skill as opposed to just the qualification that people come out of universities with. So it's more about the practical application and being able to actually do the job that we are seeing is attracting pay and employers are willing to invest in.
Important in all of this is personalization and flexibility when it comes to reward structures. Explain that to me and how an organization goes about applying their mind to it.
There's this concept of responsible flexibility, Jeremy, in terms of static reward structures being outdated, as we have seen in quite a lot of organizations and how they are reviewing their total reward proposition or their value propositions, and particularly, as you've said, in terms of what they offer from a salary and benefits perspective. So people in simple terms, for instance, I think a lot of benefit structures would include your traditional retirement plan, risk, medical aid, and so on. What we're seeing employers do to be responsive to what people actually need now is looking at the way that companies offer this retirement benefit. So it's no longer a one-size-fits-all, but it allows for people to structure their retirement savings in a way that aligns to where they are in their life stage. So people that are close to retirement are, for instance, allowed to save more, whilst those that may have a bit more time to save can save slightly lower, but obviously without compromising the need to save, because that's very important. We are also seeing the value proposition look at broader elements of support, financial well-being being one area where we're seeing a lot of organizations investing in financial education, empowerment, so that people can actually manage their money more effectively. Mental health, wellness, and all those support elements are also coming in very strongly as part of the benefits offered by organizations.
And add to that the whole idea of flexible work models, which I think are still part of the conversation. I'm on record as saying I'm not a fan, but I understand how important it is. These hybrid remote options, are they helping broaden the talent pool and improve retention? Is that now become almost a given when it comes to the hiring process?
It is an expectation. As to whether it's a given, it depends on the employer and what type of services they offer to their clients. So it's really very much role-based. I think those organizations that are able to service their clients through flexible work model arrangements are offering it, but we are also seeing quite a lot of organizations emphasize the importance of creating a culture through interpersonal relations and also getting back to basics when it comes to how to differentiate themselves in terms of how clients are supported. Mm-hmm. So yes, there's a lot of digitizing of services, but there's also a back to basics approach in terms of making sure that clients, whenever they need personal support, are provided with that personal support.
And just a last question. I referenced at the start of our conversation businesses turning to AI-driven recruitment tools. I'm just wondering whether this is helping or harming sort of equity and inclusion goals, and what HR teams need to watch out for in this particular space.
There's the emphasis on ethical use of AI in these processes, Jeremy. So you are absolutely right. Quite a lot of organizations are using AI to streamline the hiring process. We are also seeing quite a few being conscious of the fact that algorithms that come with these AI tools can lead to bias, and that is not necessarily a appropriate outcome. So some of these tools are now being enhanced to make sure that they manage potential bias, which could obviously lead to challenges, especially in a country where employment equity and achieving related targets are still quite an important aspect of the recruitment process. So yes, from a process efficiency perspective, matching requirements of a job with the CVs that are coming in, we are seeing quite a lot of use of AI, but we also hoping that organizations use these tools ethically and manage potential biases therein.
Yeah, I mean, that is absolutely critical, isn't it? And that's also a glimpse at the new world of work. Lindiwe Sebesho, thank you very much indeed. Master Reward Specialist and Executive Committee Member at the South African Reward Association. And that is where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.